All right, so it's a pleasure to be here today. I want to thank Guy and the rest of the team at Mesa for having me here and for all of you for coming. This is a talk about some research that my colleague Rahul Talang and I, and you'll meet Rahul later on this afternoon, have been doing at Carnegie Mellon. We're both trained in economics, statistics, and marketing, and are really interested in how technology changes markets. And about 10 years ago, we got really interested in the entertainment industry and how technology changes markets for entertainment. We've been doing research on this topic for, again, about the last 10 years. About the last 3 years through a research center we have at Carnegie Mellon called the Initiative for Digital Entertainment Analytics, IDEA, where we've done a lot of work with each of the six major studios, with a lot of the major record labels and with major publishers, hopefully on questions that you find interesting. Most of our work has been about piracy. So can I ask how many people read Torrent Freak? All right, shame on all of you. But my pet peeve on this is if you read sites like Torrent Freak, you'll be left with the false impression that there's an active debate going on in academia about whether piracy hurts sales or not. And in fact, the exact opposite is true. So if you leave with nothing else from this talk, there have been 25 journal articles published in peer-reviewed academic journals on the question of does piracy hurt sales. Three of those have found no statistically significant effect. And if you're following the design of the slide, 22 of those articles have found that piracy does exactly what you'd expect it to do. It causes it to be harder to sell your content. So if you're ever at a cocktail party and somebody's talking about how we don't know whether piracy hurts sales or not, you have my permission to smack them around a little bit with some actual facts. And then you also might want to think about finding different cocktail parties. The other question we've looked at is, does piracy hurt innovation? And it turns out that, and this is a very nice paper my colleague wrote, where it turns out there's good evidence that piracy does exactly what you'd expect it to do. When creators can make less money from creating content, they're less inclined to invest in high-quality content in the future. So what we see is when piracy goes up, the number of movies that get made in Bollywood went down, and the quality of those movies went down as well. We've also looked at what can you do about this. So what anti-piracy options are available? We're trying a variety of different things in the industry, some focused on the supply side of the question, some focused on the demand side of the question, some mandated by government, some voluntary. And a couple years ago, Rahul and I tried to say, hey, let's sit down and try to come up with some studies that target each of these quadrants. And it turns out, again, anti-piracy measures do exactly what you'd expect them to do. When you make it harder to consume piracy, either by making it legally risky to consume piracy, or by shutting down prominent pirate sites like Mega Upload, or by using domain blocking tools in the UK to not resolve the domain names for certain piracy sites, all of these tend to move consumers from piracy back toward legal sales. And we've got one dealing with the CC UK program that we're currently working on, a randomized experiment to try to see how notice sending to consumers will affect. And so stay tuned on that one. In addition to anti-piracy, you can also use pro-legal measures. So what the data say is that when you make content available in legal digital channels, piracy goes down and it helps your sales. And what's really interesting, over and over again, we've seen that digital distribution doesn't cannibalize your hard goods sales, doesn't cannibalize DVD sales, that these are two separate markets. The digital consumer is different than the physical consumer. And we've done some studies on marketing strategies. Do delayed international releases in the presence of piracy hurt sales? And it turns out that they do. And can you optimize your release strategies? A couple years ago, we did a study on DVD releases in iTunes at a time when a lot of the studios were delaying their iTunes release to increase DVD sales. And what the data show is that if you release on iTunes about 2 weeks before the DVD, you double your iTunes sales without changing your DVD sales. In part because, as piracy geeks know, every DVD that's released is available on piracy about 2 weeks before the legal release date. We've also done a lot of fun studies with individual studios. How do long-tail markets change consumer behavior? We're currently doing some really interesting studies with one of the studios optimizing on randomized experiments to optimize prices and experiments to help them understand the effectiveness of online promotion strategies. We've looked at, you know, does theatrical viewership help or hurt DVD sales? And it turns out it helps, that when more people in a particular market see a movie, your DVD sales are higher than they otherwise would be. And we've had a lot of fun doing these studies. So again, for the last 10 years, we've been wandering around your business asking questions. While we were doing that, we started to ask a bigger question. And this is sort of what I want to focus on today. Is technology changing the structure of power in your industry? There are a variety of reasons that you could argue the answer is no. And in fact, from a historical perspective, the answer is almost certainly no. We had a senior person from one of the studios come to talk to our class, and Rahul actually asked him, you know, are you worried about the fact that Amazon and Netflix and Google own your customer and are increasingly powerful in the industry? And his answer was, you know what, the same six studios have dominated this business for the last 100 years. There's a reason for that. And in one sense, that's 100% correct historically. The same six studios have dominated this industry. And not just this industry. Each one of the major entertainment industries has been dominated by 3 to 6 major powerful firms over the last 100 years. And those firms have been relatively stable in spite of massive shifts in how content is created, distributed, and consumed. So there's a sense in which you could look at this and say, there's really nothing different here, right? If we've survived all these other disruptions, why would this be any different? The other reason you might argue that this isn't going to change power in the industry is that none of the individual shifts we see going on seem to be all that concerning. So in a book we just finished, we outline five what we think are major technological shifts affecting the business right now. And if you look at these individually, none of them seems like a big problem, right? User-generated content, the rise of user-generated content is really just cats riding Roombas. You know, it doesn't compete with the high-quality content that's coming out of the entertainment industry. Long-tail markets are populated by low-selling, failed products. They don't compete with the blockbuster part of the business. Digital piracy hurts sales, but it affects everybody in the industry equally. Everybody gets hurt by piracy, so it shouldn't upset the competitive balance. Sure, you've got a bunch of powerful online distributors, but they still rely on you for their content, so they're not going to disrupt the industry. And as we all know, you can't use big data to create content, right? So big data isn't a threat either. And so it seems that there are some really good reasons to believe that technology is not going to disrupt the industry. And yet, it sure feels like things are changing. It sure feels like this is a significant shift in the entertainment industry that we all know and love. And a couple years ago, Rahul and I decided to write a book about this question. It's called Streaming, Sharing, Stealing, Big Data and the Future of Entertainment. It's available on Amazon. I think we get $1.17 every time a book sells. So both of us have kids we need to send to college. I would encourage you all. But as you read it, I hope you'll read it as coming from two people who have really benefited in terms of research by doing work with you guys, two people who care a lot about this industry, and two people who would really like to see this industry succeed. And so our honest goal in writing this book was to take some of the frameworks we've been using in class and try to explain why we think this really is a fundamental shift in the industry. And most importantly, what can you do to respond? Because as I'll talk about in a second, we're actually quite optimistic about the future of this industry in spite of the challenges that are going on now. Okay? So let me try to break down these frameworks. And again, these are the frameworks we've been using in class to talk to our students. And you know, we started to feel a little bit guilty. We didn't want to be the sort of people who said, oh yeah, we saw this 5 years ago and have been talking about this to our students, but we decided not to tell this to anybody in the industry because we were afraid of offending them. So the first framework I'd like for you to think about is, why do we do business the way we do? So the market you guys all face, as I'm sure you know, is one where the cost to make content is incredibly high. The fixed costs are incredibly high to make content, $100 million movies. The marginal cost to make an additional copy of that is relatively low, a couple bucks to print that movie on a DVD. Channel capacity is incredibly scarce. You know, how many movies can you show at an AMC 12? I think the answer is actually 12. You know, but it's really hard and incredibly important to get your movies in those 12 movies that are shown in these scarce channels. And then you have opportunities through copyright law and through other enforcement techniques to control when people get access to the content, right? And in the presence of these market characteristics, the industry's done exactly what economic theory would say you should do. You've focused on selling individual products to an audience who has incredibly different valuations for that product, and you've created a set of windows that allow you to sell to the high-value consumers at a high price while still selling to the low-value consumers at a low price. All right? So if you want to watch it right after release, I'm going to charge you 10 to 15 bucks to watch it in the theaters, and you can watch it once. If you're willing to wait 3 months, you can watch it on DVD, and you can watch it as many times as you want. If you're willing to wait 6 months after that, you can watch it on pay cable, and you get the idea. Okay. The question we've been asking our students is, in this world, why have 3 to 6 major firms dominated the business? And the answer comes down to their huge economies of scale associated with the ability to control the scarce financial and technical resources necessary to create content, and a huge economies of scale associated with getting your content onto the scarce channels. And you generate profit by being able to control when people get access to your content. All of the business models, I'll generalize a little bit here, all the business models in the entertainment industry are predicated on the idea that I can control when Will gets access to the DVD, and I can control what quality he gets access. The question is, what would happen if all of these market characteristics changed at the same time? So let me be a little bit careful here. I don't want to offend anybody, but I would argue that we now have the ability to create content that has both low and high fixed cost of production. The example I'm thinking of is my two sons like to watch epic rap battles of history on YouTube. Any ERB fans? Okay, one. Thank you very much. Apparently, these guys made their first three videos on a budget of 50 bucks, and they now have 13 million subscribers on YouTube. An even more shameful example is my daughter likes to watch videos of other people playing Minecraft, you know? An activity that I don't approve of, but apparently there's nothing I can do about it, but you know, that basically you're able to make with the HD camera that most people carry around in their pocket. Now, I'm not arguing you're going to be able to create Avatar with the HD camera you carry around in your pocket, right? Even the iPhone 7, you can't create Avatar. But I think that this sort of entertainment actually does propose a significant challenge. Going back to the idea that, you know, user-generated content doesn't compete with Avatar, when I talk about competition in class, the point I try to make to my students is, in a market economy, you don't get to choose who your competitor is. Your competitor is anybody who is taking your customers away from you. And if people are starting to watch YouTube videos of, you know, silly epic rap battles of history and of people playing Minecraft, that's your competitor, all right? We've also moved from a world where it cost a couple bucks to print something on DVD to a world where the marginal cost of producing an additional copy of a digital good is essentially zero. And this means, you know, in a world where it cost you a couple bucks to print something on a DVD, anybody whose value is less than a couple bucks is shut out of the market. Now, when the marginal cost is zero, everybody's a potential customer, and you actually benefit by finding as many people as possible who are going to be able to consume this content. We've moved to a world where channel capacity is unlimited, you know, where YouTube and Netflix can put up a whole bunch of content and doesn't have to worry about the 12 screens at the AMC multiplex. And then lastly, as I talked about before, we've moved to a world where piracy, while there are things you can do about it, both on the anti-piracy side and the pro-legal side, you can't put the genie back in the bottle, unfortunately. And that messes with all of your business models, because now when Will is thinking about, you know, do I want to pay 15 bucks for the DVD, he knows in the back of his mind that that same DVD is available online, frequently a couple weeks before the legal release date. You don't mind me picking on you, do you, Will? All right, thanks. So in some ways, the same characteristics that didn't look all that threatening when you look at them separately, I would argue, and Rahul would argue as well, are actually changing the traditional sources of power that the major firms have enjoyed for the last 100 years. And technology has created, we would argue, a whole new business model, and one that just wasn't possible before. And that's creating massive on-demand bundles of content that are sold in a subscription model. The key here is using this content to create, what the economic theory tells you is these on-demand bundles allow you to do a better job of creating value and also a better job of extracting value than you could in the individual content model. So what the data and evidence tell you is our tastes are far more varied than what you can find on an AMC 12 multiplex. Again, no disrespect. That allowing people and helping people to find exactly that piece of content that their unique tastes allow them to love releases a whole bunch of value for them. And you can't do that in any of the traditional channels that have very limited capacity and that are primarily broadcast. The economic theory also tells you that when you put a whole bunch of content in a big bundle, you can actually extract far more value from the market than you can by selling the same goods individually. That the nature of the bundle allows me to do a much better job of predicting your average value for the total content. I don't have to worry about, are you a high-value consumer or a low-value consumer? I can say, I'm going to throw a whole bunch of content in the bundle. You're going to love Longmire. You're not going to love Fuller House that much, but you still might like it a little bit. On average, I can do a really good job of predicting your valuation. And so there's a sense in which these new channels give the platforms a better way of creating value and a better way of extracting value. And they also change the sources of market power. What the economic theory tells you is that bigger bundles beat smaller bundles. So a key part of the advantage in this new business model is having a large platform with a lot of content on it. The challenge, though, of a world where you've got 10,000 different movies is how do I help you find exactly the movie that's going to be interesting to you? You know, the search cost of finding a movie in the midst of 10,000 different options are huge. And this is where I think the other factor comes in, that Netflix and Amazon and Google are doing a great job of understanding my unique preferences and how they're different from Will's unique preferences and showing us exactly the content that's going to appeal to us. I was giving this talk at the business school at Carnegie Mellon to some undergrads, and I was sort of waxing philosophic about Netflix, and there was this young undergrad woman in the front row, and you know, she raises her hand and says, you know, I don't understand how Netflix designs their front page. Like, they've got a whole row dedicated to movies with strong female leads. I don't understand why, you know, why would you have a whole row? And I said, you know, would it surprise you to know I've never seen that row? You know, that row is just for you. And based on your unique characteristics. And that's a beautiful thing. So one way to think about this is, I would argue, these five shifts, if you look at them separately, aren't a threat. But if you look at them in the context of all happening at the same time, are creating a world that are weakening the existing sources of market power in the existing business model, and creating a new business model that has new sources of market power, and market power that are going to be difficult but not impossible for the traditional studios to go after. The analogy we use in the book is of the perfect storm, right? You've got a group of fishermen who have survived many storms in the past, and they go out in their boat, and they don't realize that they aren't facing a traditional storm. They're actually facing the confluence of multiple storms hitting their boat at the same time. So this brings us to an interesting question. How can the traditional leaders in this industry respond? And this is where I would argue the analogy breaks down, right? We all know how the perfect storm ends. Well, I don't want to spoil it for you. But we're actually much more optimistic about the future of this industry than you'd get from watching the perfect storm. And so the last part of our book, we're trying to talk about some very specific things that the industry can do to respond. So I teach a lot of cases, and I apologize for this, but you know, if I were teaching this at a case, what I would say is, what can the incumbent firm do that's going to be very hard for the entrant to copy? And the answer is, you guys have, you know, 50 to 100 years of history creating great content that people love. You've got these wonderful deep catalogs. It's pretty clear that Netflix is trying to create the deep catalogs faster than you guys can create a great platform. I would argue that you have a unique advantage using that catalog to get into this on-demand streaming game. What we've seen in the industry are a bunch of networks and a bunch of studios using their deep catalog to create online, over-the-top platforms and sites. My one concern about this is, if you go back to the sources of market power, if you go back to the economies of scale in the on-demand streaming business, what you see are bigger bundles beat smaller bundles, and more broad data coverage actually allows you to make better recommendations than you could make with smaller data coverage. And my fear of having a bunch of studios with a bunch of individual on-demand platforms is, you're not going to be able to make as good a use of those two sources of economies of scale as you would if you were able to partner. NBC is only going to see behavior on NBC content and is only going to see the customers who visit their site. They're not going to have a broader view of what those customers do on other sites, and the same for the other studios as well. So let me be a little bit provocative here and say, wouldn't it be great if the studios had an established streaming platform that, because of the ownership structure, was likely going to be very friendly towards allowing the studios to have access to the data, right? Wouldn't that be awesome? All right, so, you know, it's over in Santa Monica, Hulu headquarters, right? That I wonder whether we could make better use of the resources that you already have in place to create a world where we do have a centralized platform, we do have centralized data collection about customers, and that data can be shared back with each of the member studios in a way that, no disrespect to Todd and the other folks, but in a way that Netflix, Amazon, and Google just aren't sharing data with you, giving you access to those unique customers and their unique characteristics. The other thing we argue in the book is that, and again, due respect and no intention to disrespect, I think there's a need for some pretty radical changes around the culture within the studios. The example that we use in the book is Harrah's Casino. Harrah's Casino is a case I use in class a lot. And the case starts with Harrah's Casino being run as a bunch of individual casino properties, where each casino has its own profit and loss, each casino has its own data, they make their own marketing decisions, and they're all run relatively separately under the Harrah's brand name. They've historically had very little data about customers, so data hasn't really been that important. And because they had very little data about customers, historically they've made primarily gut feel decisions about what are the best promotions and what are the best services to offer these customers. Right around the time that scanner cards start to become popular, they realize that, Will is a customer of the Las Vegas Harrah's, and wouldn't it be nice if I knew who he was when he visits the Atlantic City Harrah's? Wouldn't it be nice if I had data about him that I could use across the business? And what they do is they make this massive investment in structural change within the casinos. So they hire Gary Loveman as the chief operating officer. And Gary Loveman comes in and says, you know what? All of your data that you've been keeping in your own little silos, it belongs to me now. And we're going to start making promotional decisions centrally. He also makes some very aggressive senior analytics hires. I don't want to frighten anybody in the room, but every year Amazon comes to the American Economic Association and hires something like 20 to 30 PhD economists to come to their headquarters in Seattle and do a good job of analyzing their data. The other thing Gary Loveman did is not just change the structure, he also changed the culture. So there's this wonderful line in the case where he comes in and says, you know what, if I discover we did something in marketing without testing it, I'll kill people. I don't know if he literally, I mean, it is Las Vegas, he might literally kill people, but, and so there's this other, and this is my favorite line in the whole case, right? So we run everything in Harrah's with control groups. It's like you don't harass women, you don't steal, and you've got to have a control group. Not having a control group is one of those things that can get you fired at Harrah's Casino. And then the last thing they do is they start to run experiments. So the conventional wisdom in the casino industry at the time of the case was the best way to get Will to come back is to give him a free steak dinner, a free room, and $30 in chips, which cost the casino about $125. Harrah's ran an experiment where they compared the effectiveness of that strategy to just giving Will $60 in chips. And what they discovered is that the $60 in chips is far more effective at getting Will back in the door. They ran a very nice control treatment. And getting back to the studies we're running with this studio, in a lot of the things we're finding that the conventional wisdom about prices, the conventional wisdom about promotion, are actually very different than what the data tell you about what's most effective today. Okay? And then the coda to this whole story is when Gary Loveman stepped down in 2013, the most valuable part of his contribution to the company was a 45 million database of users that was valued at something like $1 billion for the company. So this industry that previously had been all about the physical properties was now generating huge, huge value from this virtual source of data. I hope you see the analogy by now. As Rahul and I have been wandering around the studios, I'm worried that you look a lot like Harrah's Casino did at the beginning of the case. We see a lot of siloed business units and siloed data, and we've been in a lot of discussions at studios where we'll be talking about a cool research project, and the people will say, oh, that's a great idea, but you know, the television group or the theatrical group owns that data and they're never going to share it with us. This happens over and over and over again. You've historically had very little data about customers, so maybe that was the right way to organize for a while, you know, to create this competition between the different business units. But I think now that data is becoming a much bigger part of your business, it's time to change that. I would also argue that centralizing data in the organization, as Harrah's did, as Amazon does, as apparently Netflix does, will allow you to use data much more efficiently. You know, not surprisingly, when data is much more useful when linked. It's much more valuable to me to know Will as not just someone who consumes DVDs, but also someone who watches movies in the theater and who watches movies on television, and to get a much better holistic view of who he is. Having a centralized data group also allows you to make better use of talent. I was at Legendary Pictures, and they're actually organized this way. I was sitting around a table with a bunch of analysts. Some of them were trained on experimental design. Some of them were trained on surveys. Some of them were trained on machine learning. Some were trained on Bayesian analysis. And what they were saying is that by having that team central in the company, if I've got a question that requires survey design and Bayesian analysis, I can pull exactly the right people in to answer that question. I think it makes it easier to retain talent. And the last thing, and again, due respect, I think it increases objectivity in the analysis. We've wandered around the studios enough to know that when an analyst sits within the business unit and the person who's writing my performance review wants the answer to be something, I'm much more likely to make sure that the answer is exactly what I know my boss wants it to be, as opposed to saying what the data say. So in the book, we spend the last part recommending that there's some pretty significant changes in the structure of the industry, organizing things centrally, changing data analytics to a C-level function, and changing the culture to one where you start to make decisions based not on gut feel, not on what we've been doing for the past 10 years, but on what the data tell you is going to be most effective. And I'll close with that and just say, if you read the book and if any of these ideas might be useful to you in the studio, Rahul and I have tenure at Carnegie Mellon. We're much more excited about using this to make changes in how this industry we love and have benefited so much from runs. And if you see any opportunities for us to come out and talk about these ideas, or if you'd like to talk about, you know, particular research projects, our emails are up and we'd be more than happy to talk to you. Fair? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael Smith. Fantastic. Rahul will be up later moderating a session.